I'm Kay Potter for KHOI Community Radio, and this is KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals and issues of note in central Iowa. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce two special guests who'll give us some in-depth insights into the connections between music and neurology. They'll acquaint us with some of the many benefits that music, musical training, and music therapy can provide in early childhood and also in alleviating conditions like ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and conditions like Parkinson's disease and dementia. So all that's coming up. But before we get into all these fascinating issues, I'd just like to remind all our listeners that this is our fall fund drive, and I've got a message about that. KHOI is your renewable resource. It's a renewable resource that keeps coming back to you each and every day. And it's a renewable resource that relies on your renewed support in order to provide the quality programs you've come to trust and love. Like all renewable resources, KHOI is there for you every day, 365 days a year, powering you through your day with great music and with local and international news. Like all renewable resources, it takes careful stewardship to keep it going. So please pick up the phone right now, call us at 515-292-2878, and tell the volunteer who answers the phone, "I want to protect my renewable resource. I want to become a member of KHOI. I've been thinking about this for days, and the time has come for me to do my part." Our goal is to sign up 25 new members this fall. If you're already a member, consider renewing now or moving on to a higher level of support. Call now, 515-292-2878, or text us at 515-200-7758. Or pledge securely online at our website, khoifm.org. Help renew this renewable resource. Basic KHOI membership is $55, but we'd appreciate a $100 donation for membership. Or consider becoming one of our friends of KHOI. People who donate $250 or more to build a foundation of KHOI's Operations Fund. Once again, that's 515-292-2878 on the phone, or text us at 515-200-7758, or pledge securely online at our website, khoifm.org. And thank you. And now back to music and neurology. I mentioned before the break that music can be beneficial to people with Parkinson's disease. And here's a testimony from Ames resident Peggy Garau, who attends a singing group especially for people with Parkinson's disease. Now, I'm talking to Peggy Garau, who's one of the participants in the singing group here. Why don't you tell us what you like about the group, Peggy?
Well, everybody comes happy and ready to sing and have a good time. And so it's truly the most fun I have all week.
And pretty soon we'll meet the person responsible for organizing that singing group. But first, here's a brief clip from the latest session of the group so you can hear them all enjoying themselves.
Tater. Sooner or later. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a potato. Sooner or later, I baked a potato. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a potato. How you do, how you do, how you do.
Lasagna's the last one. There's one in between.
Tortilla.
If I was gonna see ya.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a tortilla. If I was gonna see ya, I'd baked a tortilla. If I knew you were coming.
person who's responsible for organizing and running that singing group for people with Parkinson's disease is Dr. Elizabeth Stegmuller, a professor of kinesiology at Iowa State University. Dr. Stegmuller is also a music therapist and a neuroscientist, and she's one of my guests today. My other guest is a student of Dr. Stegmuller's, Patricia Izbicki, who's a graduate student doing research on the neurological effects of music on various human complaints and conditions. Welcome to both of you.
And we're starting with talking about Parkinson's disease. Could you talk a bit more about the particular benefits of music to people with Parkinson's?
Yes. My main area of research is to understand how music can facilitate movement in people with Parkinson's disease and then what is happening in the brain.
Okay. So you are in the Department of Kinesiology, so I guess that fits.
Yeah. Yes. So, and I'm a board-certified music therapist by trade, and so I have worked in rehabilitation settings and with people with Parkinson's disease for a while, and I've noticed that when they move with music, they actually move better, and some of their symptoms go away. For example, people with Parkinson's disease often have difficulty with freezing when they're walking, so they might have to go through a doorway, and they have difficulty starting to walk, and they're just kind of stuck. And when we use music to walk with, we see that that freezing is no longer there. They're mm-hmm. able to overcome it. And so there isn't much research that actually can tell us why that works. And so that's kind of what we're doing in the lab, is to try to understand what is happening in the brain. And once we know that, then we can apply music more therapeutically for this population. And so that's kind of one area of research. And a second area of research is with singing. And this one, we've had a few more results published most recently. We did an 8-week singing study where folks with Parkinson's disease would come in and sing once a week. And again, the goal of the study and of the singing sessions was not to make somebody a better singer, but to actually work on respiratory control, swallow, and even improve the voice, because people with Parkinson's disease often have difficulties with all of these areas due to the disease. And what we found with the research is that we improved swallow and respiratory control, and that significantly, and that voice also improved, but it didn't reach significance. But regardless, because Parkinson's disease is a progressive disease, mm-hmm. it gets worse, just the fact that they got better is a pretty outstanding result.
Yes. So it was more than just halting the disease, the progression. It actually went backwards.
It got better.
Right.
Which is a really big deal, because complications from swallow impairment is one of the leading causes of death in people with Parkinson's disease.
Because they can't swallow their food? Or?
Yeah. Thin liquids will kind of seep down into the lungs, and then because they can't cough those thin liquids out because they have reduced respiratory control, then it develops into aspiration pneumonia.
Mm.
And it becomes one of the leading causes. It is one of the leading causes of death, and there really is no, the current forms of treatment in Parkinson's disease do not help with this problem.
Okay, so it helps in all these areas, swallowing.
Yeah.
And okay, now you mentioned the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, you're looking at areas of the brain that are activated when they hear music when you do this.
Our most important areas that we're looking at are the areas that control movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Parkinson's disease, while there are a bunch of symptoms, the major symptoms affect how people move. And so we're looking at those areas to see how those motor cortical areas change while listening to music, while moving with music. And then we also are looking pre and post intervention. So we'll be looking at what does it look like before you do the 8-week singing training, and what does it look like after? Do we see changes in the brain?
And have we come to any tentative conclusions about that yet?
We laugh. Well, we are working on those results. We do know that music definitely changes motor cortical activity, motor activity in the brain related to movement, just by listening to it,
mm-hmm.
Which is pretty phenomenal that you can modulate that area of the brain just by listening to music. So most of the time you would expect to see different parts of the brain become active or change when you're actively using that part of the brain. So if you're moving, you would think that then that part of the brain would be active and could be changed. But in the cases where you're listening to music, we do see that these same motor areas are being modulated just from listening.
So even, I mean, forgetting about Parkinson's for a minute, if I'm just sitting here listening to a concert or something, the motor areas of my brain will be moving.
Exactly.
Meaning I want to move, really.
Yeah.
So it comes naturally with music.
Yes.
People
yes, sit exactly.
so still in concerts.
I know.
It's not natural.
You're supposed to move with music.
Okay. That was Patricia speaking up. I should say, tell everybody that Patricia's got earrings on that look like piano keyboards. So they're very appropriate. I was just thinking what you were saying about people freezing, say when they're trying to come through a door or something. Now, suppose I'm someone with Parkinson's and I'm standing there and I'm frozen and I can't move. Suppose I start singing to myself. Would that help?
Yes. I would say what I always recommend is actually the song You Are My Sunshine, because there's like pickups to it. You are my sun. And then you want to step on sunshine, because the beats that come before it actually help to prepare the brain to know when to move.
Oh.
And so, and there's quite a bit of literature out there that shows that providing those preparatory, whether they be auditory cues or music, helps to know when to take that step. And so something, it doesn't have to be You Are My Sunshine. I just know it's an easy one for most people to sing and remember. And nobody looks at you weird if you're singing while you're walking. So it's kind of
or humming.
That sort of thing. And there's plenty of music out there. One of the most important things is not only for it to be familiar, but something that you like. Because if you don't like it, you're not going to use it anyway.
Right. Now, how about the difference between singing it for myself and just having a recording ready to switch on?
So both will work. There's been some anecdotal reports of a gentleman with Parkinson's disease that used to wear headphones when he would go out for a walk, and mm-hmm. that would help him to keep walking. But this was back in the day. Well, I guess batteries still go dead.
His battery was always going dead.
He got to the park and the battery went dead. And he was stuck and he wasn't real sure what to do. And so then he kind of calmed himself down and began singing to himself and was able to get back home. So anecdotally, we would say that both would work. And as a music therapist, we would use live music first to help the person get used to it, know what to do, how to do it. And eventually our goal is to fade the music therapist or fade the therapist. We don't want to fade the music, obviously, because that's working. But eventually you want them to be able to take music and use it independently of the therapist.
Right.
So whether that be singing in your head or singing yourself or your caregiver or your spouse singing with you, I think for the most part what we know is that would still work.
Mm-hmm. Now, Patricia, I'd like to ask you at this point, you are studying music, so you expect to be a music therapist, do you, when you...
No, so I am getting my PhD. Unfortunately, I'm not a candidate yet, so right now, hopefully in a year, I will have... But I am actually studying or getting my PhD in neuroscience, so mm-hmm. I have a music performance background, not a music therapy background, but music therapy and then also music and medicine have always interested me because I've seen the effects on even people who don't have any kind of neuropsychiatric or neurologic disorders, and so... That was Dr. S and I met, and the rest is history.
Okay. So could you say a bit more about that, the effects of music on people that don't have any neurological complaints?
Yep. So I'm mainly interested in how music training impacts different individuals, specifically adults. And so my research will mainly be focused on that, so I can talk a little bit about how just music lessons and music training can,
sure,
can
go
impact.
Ahead.
Mainly, if you think about when you're playing an instrument, you have the piece of music in front of you, so you're not only using the visual areas of your brain, you're moving, so you're using the motor cortex, just like when you're listening to music, that area is activated, right? Either you're playing a piano, or you're singing, or you're playing some other instrument. And then you have your frontal regions, which are really working with things like, first of all, inhibition, so not getting distracted, and working memory, so remembering what you just played in order to keep on playing. And you also have, very importantly, your temporal lobes or your auditory cortex, so that responsible for actually hearing the music and processing. So you're getting a full brain workout, mm-hmm, when you're playing any sort of instrument. And so because of that, we've seen so many different, you know, enhancements in those in musicians versus non-musicians, and I can go in a little bit into,
sure,
that. So you see not only structural enhancements, so when you're learning a skill, so let's say you're learning to play a piece of music. In your brain, you have these cells called neurons, and you have so many of them. They're around between 60 to 100 billion. We're not going to argue about that today, but there's just so many. That's mainly the point to get across. And every time you're learning a skill, these cells kind of branch out to each other and connect with other cells that are, or other neurons that are used in that skill. And so
the connections.
Yes, the connections.
The synapses, I believe.
Yes, the synapses, exactly. And so the more and more you practice that piece, the more and more synapses you're going to get. And those actually, they're actually going to change the structure in your brain. So you're going to have more gray matter, so to speak. So just a little bit more brain. And you see that in actual studies where you use something called structural magnetic resonance imaging, or just MRI. Most everyone is kind of familiar with that one. And so you see that, but so that's already interesting in itself, that there's some kind of, you know, neuroplasticity going on, so
right,
to speak. But then you have, do those have any kinds of effects on what we do every day, or any enhancements? And so we see not only enhancements in speech processing. So for example, musicians are generally better able to hear in noise. So like if you're at a cocktail party, right, there's a lot of things going on and you want to be able to listen to your partner that you're talking with. And so musicians generally are better able to do that.
So they're better tuning out the distractions.
Exactly.
Concentrating.
So that also just better, they have better memory, working memory, right, because you have to remember what's going on. What's really interesting also is in terms of, well, I'll get to older adults because that's also very interesting, but in terms of children, several studies have shown that music training is even associated with accelerated brain maturation. So we don't have any proof, okay, that's what's really causing these enhancements in
kids. But there's a correlation there.
Yeah.
Not
so
necessarily a causation.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's something might be there for that.
Could I just ask a bit more about tuning out distractions? That made me think of people with, or kids with ADHD. Mm-hmm. Has been any work done with that?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so you hit on one of my future process. So my research is really involving inhibition, so the ability to be able to tune out different distractions, but mainly these are cognitive. So mainly when I talk about inhibition, it's being able to stop certain types of behavior or actions. So
like, impulse control.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm really interested in if this ability to control distractibility, to stop and control distractibility, as well as excessive movement, if there's an enhancement in that.
Mm-hmm.
And as we age, we become a little bit worse in those types of actions as well, and seeing whether musicians have this.
You mean they become, older people have fewer inhibitions?
So it's mainly, I wouldn't generalize.
Less impulse control.
I would say a little bit less in terms of distractibility and excessive movements. They have a harder time controlling and stopping excessive movements,
okay,
and then in terms of distractibility.
But, no, it seems strange. You know, the trouble is to get old people to move. So.
And so if I'd step in a little bit about like motor inhibition, it's not necessarily keeping somebody from moving, but stopping inappropriate movements.
Sure.
So more like clumsiness or fine motor control. You want to make sure when you're picking something up that other parts that aren't supposed to move are inhibited. Otherwise, right. It could interfere.
Okay.
All right. And so those are the type of things that they see with aging is those other fine control of movements where you really shouldn't use your pinky kind of gets in the way and that causes you to drop something or mishandle something.
Yeah,
that's the sort of
that.
Inhibition.
I was trained at one point as a yoga teacher, and that's one of the things that you don't make any unnecessary movements.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now we'll take time for another break to ask for your support. 11 years ago, community radio in central Iowa was at best an impossible-sounding dream. But in 2006, a small, dedicated group of volunteers began the six-year-long path to making it really happen. Now we have a fully functioning radio station with a professional, dignified, and beautiful workspace for producers, administrators, and the community, created by scores of volunteers from our own community. We've been on the air for 24/7 for over 5 years. We know that running a station like this on donations is very ambitious. Even with all our volunteer labor, it costs us around $8,000 a month to operate KHOI. But on the wall of our little transmitter house by the radio tower in Story City, these words are written: wish it, dream it, do it. We've dreamed a community radio station. Help us to continue to do it and live it. Become a member of KHOI today or upgrade your support if you're already a member. Basic membership is only $55 a year or about 15 cents a day. And right now, thanks to a $30,000 challenge grant provided by generous listeners, every dollar you give will mean $2 for KHOI. Just call 515-292-2878 or text us at 515-200-758 or log on to khoifm.org and help us continue to live the KHOI dream. Okay, go on, Patricia.
I think in terms of that's really my interest in, and there hasn't been a lot of work done in terms of music training in ADHD, and it's a hard thing to do because it's not only getting participants but also working with that specific population. So mm-hmm. In this case, it's there would have to be, and that's a music therapist to be working with those. But hopefully, either children or adults, depending. But it's just a more complex study. So it's really important to have a good foundation
sure.
of evidence before you pursue something like that.
The professor is now patting the student on the shoulder. She said the right thing there. Okay. Now, I don't know if this is the next natural progression, but how about music in elementary education?
Well, I'm a proponent, for sure. So I think one of the things that Patricia talked about was neuroplasticity. And so we can talk a little bit about how music helps the brain make new connections. And there's some, unique factors in music that aren't there with some other learning strategies or even other therapies. And so one of the most interesting things is that just listening to music that you enjoy increases dopamine. And dopamine is a neurotransmitter right. in the brain. And
associated with pleasure.
With pleasure, but also with learning. So a lot of times, once you get past the age of 3, You actually have to focus and pay attention in order to learn something.
You mean before three it's easier?
Yes. Usually before three you kind of soak up the environment. If you think about little kids that somehow learn that bad word that you have no idea how they learned it. They probably heard it somewhere.
Well, especially if it's spoken with emotion.
Yes. So, but after that, the brain actually goes through a developmental change in which you actually need dopamine to be present in order to learn anything new and to make those new connections. So it's like a modulatory connection. So our modulatory transmitter. So the fact that music would increase that is kind of like increasing the chemicals or the neurotransmitters in your brain that you need to learn. So it can help with learning. We also know that to make new connections in the brain, neurons need to fire at the same time. And they call it the Hebbian principle that neurons that fire together wire together. So, or neurons out of sync do not link. That's my other favorite one. So the cool thing about music is the rhythm. So the rhythm does help synchronize.
Right, and rhyme does. You're using rhyme there. Too.
Firing in the
Since
brain.
Since I'm a literature person, I have to get that.
Yes. And so things like that actually help make connections in the brain. And so in order to learn stuff, new stuff, like Patricia was saying earlier, you need to make those connections in the brain. And so music has some really unique properties, dopamine and rhythm. And then the final one is that music is actually less noisy. And most people don't think too much about that, but our speech signals have more noise in it than a musical signal. So if you think about the harmonics of music, what makes it music is that the harmonics naturally line up, usually within intervals of each other. But with speech, there's a little bit more noise. And the brain...
Well, you seem to be using noise in a very specialized way there.
Right. So more...
I would say variability, possibly.
I guess variability. But if you look at the frequency spectrum, if you were to look at somebody, the frequency spectrum of someone speaking versus someone that's doing an ah sound or singing, there's less frequencies represented in a musical sound than in a speech sound.
Okay.
And so the more there are more frequencies that are represented, and if they're overlapping, that's in general in the speech world or in some of the more auditory world, it can be considered as noise.
Or confusing noise, you mean?
Yeah.
Confusing sounds. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think it's maybe if we think about what sound waves look like, it's kind of... peaks and hills, and I think maybe the music is just a cleaner.
It's a nice peak
version.
And a nice hill versus
sort of jaggedy.
Yes, jaggedy would be more speech like, and the brain does not like noise.
Okay, it doesn't like that jaggedy.
Yeah, it's harder for the brain to understand and encode noisy signals. So I always like to use like the cleanup song as an example of when you sing the cleanup song with kids. All this. Before, if you tell them clean up, they look at you like you're insane. You're like, I'm not going to clean this up, or they don't know what you mean. But as soon as you start singing clean up, it's almost like, oh, we're cleaning up now. And they automatically start cleaning up. Now, it could be because the music gets their attention, but it also could be that those words are conveyed in a less noisy signal than in and that's easier, or a bit of both. Mm-hmm. It's easier for the brain to encode and understand, especially for the young brain. So those are some three principles that I think in terms of music and music education are very important to keep in mind and why we need music in our schools.
Right, and why maybe we need to educate people in general about this because... You know, I get a picture of little kids in school, you know, singing and marching around and doing things to music and having a good time. And sometimes people think, well, they're wasting their time. Why aren't they sitting there learning their letters? And but that's not a waste of time, is it?
No. If you think about it, how did we learn our letters?
Well, actually, I said I didn't learn them by marching around singing. Actually, I was no. I mean, you'd be horrified what it was like in elementary school when I was there.
And I think and again, this is more anecdotal than anything, but you see so many really high achieving professionals who are quote unquote closet musicians, and I say that quote unquote because some of them are just fantastic, really great musicians, and we don't see those effects until someone is in their 20s, 30s plus, but I mean that again, because they had that music training when they were younger. You know, it's, again, I think more anecdotal, but should also support the fact that we need music in our schools.
And often musical talent goes with mathematical talent for some reason. Oh, you don't look as if you've heard of that.
No.
I'm not very good at math.
No, I think.
So I don't know.
I know a lot of mathematicians who are also musicians, and they say, oh, this is, you know, everyone knows this.
Yep.
I think it really depends what field you're in. So I've always been a little bit more in the medical, and not necessarily. I was pre-med before I came here, and I met a lot of physicians who were just wonderful musicians, because you do have that humanistic artistic expression, and you have to communicate with others, and you have to communicate on the same level and with respect. And so, again, I feel like that's also true for the medical profession.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there are a lot of things that just being involved with music education or even a music group can teach you that you don't get in the classroom, like learning how to work together with someone else. You have to do that if you're in a singing group, if you're in an orchestra, if you're in a band. You have to know.
And you have to listen to one another, too,
and
if you're
listen.
Singing different parts.
Yeah,
and
so there's a lot that you learn just from being in a group that you don't necessarily learn from just sitting in a classroom. And those skills are very important to be successful in life, not just your academics. You could be the smartest person in the world, but if you don't know how to communicate to someone, you're not going to really go very far or work well with someone else. And so there are a lot of social skills that you learn through participation in music. And one of the great things, too, about music is it breaks down that barrier. So when you have to, like, meet someone new or start talking with somebody new, sometimes people can feel a little odd or just doesn't feel comfortable. But if you start singing with someone, it's amazing how things change almost immediately.
You say that, but a lot of people, if you ask them to sing, they get covered in confusion. In fact, one choir I used to sing in, she was working with some learning disabled adults. She was trying to teach them different words. What do you call a group of people that sing together? Guess what the answer was? Bunch of drunks.
But again,
in other words, it took the alcohol to loosen up them.
Yeah, but again, it's you know, you have that social component. Everyone had a good laugh from that, I'm sure, and just
yeah.
But
true.
I mean, those little things, and even to you know, to build off of that, I guess, is also the importance of being able to respectfully discuss what you want, you know, critique or ask the other individual, hey, maybe we play it like this or something like that, which I think in our society today, let's just say, I feel like there is usually no middle ground, or we're very quick to critique others, whereas in music you can't do that because the other person is just as invested in the music as you are. And okay. So learning that, I want to say, emotional intelligence and being able to moderate musical conflict, so to speak, will spill over into your actual life.
Sure. Although there's a similar kind of thing in other fields, you know, people working together as a team, there is an element of competition and aggression in most sports and in debating and so on. But there isn't when you're performing with people,
right.
I suppose.
You can't really be competitive because then the music won't happen.
Okay, we were talking about elementary education. How about prenatal? Is there much known about that? You know, you hear a lot about when you're pregnant, you should play all sorts of music to your baby. And what have you got to say about that?
So I'll say a few things that have actually been possibly shown. So this is mainly work from the University of Helsinki. But what they found is newborn babies are able to discriminate sounds based off of their frequency, so not as complex sounds as we're able to process. But babies are aware of that happening. I'm not sure exactly how. I think they don't know either. But it's just that they were able to find things. Like, this particular study found that babies that were exposed to or in utero to familiar melodies were able to recognize those melodies after
they were born.
But again, I think...
Well, they showed recognition by what? Turning towards the sound? Or
yeah, usually.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And again, I always... this is not my field of expertise, but I it really... You have to be very careful how... You have to be very good at understanding how babies behave. And I think that's a very big question mark as to whether or not they're actually responding to the music or something else. But again, I'm not an expert, but that's definitely a concern I always have is, are you able to accurately
to interpret what the baby's doing?
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know, Dr. S, what you...
Well, what I can tell you is premature babies. There's been a lot of literature on in music therapy. And what we know is that they've developed... Well, at first they just had... They played music, and what they noticed is the premature babies would eat more and gain weight faster than those that did not have music in the NICU. And so then they invented...
Now, wait a minute. Yes. I didn't understand that last thing. Is it in the
In the NICU.
What's that?
In the neonatal intensive care unit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So when
there's... some had music in that unit and some didn't.
And didn't. And the ones that did gained weight faster.
Okay.
And then, so then from those research, this is a work by Dr. Jane Stanley in Florida. She did, they developed a device, like a sucking device. Well, premature babies don't naturally have that reflex yet.
Right.
And so they developed a device where if the baby would suck, it would trigger music. And they did research, and even over the mother's, I think over the mother's voice, I'm pretty sure. I have to double check. But those that would get the pacifier that triggered the music would suck more than noise or the mother's voice.
Wow, that's something if it preferred it to the mother's voice.
Yes. And so it's pretty powerful the way that they can show that you can use music to help increase weight. And so that now we know that those that have music will suck more, once they learn that sucking reflex, then they'll eat more, they gain weight faster, and they're healthier, and they have a better prognosis of getting out of that neonatal intensive care unit. So it's pretty interesting.
Okay. Now, various other areas dealing with stress. Well, Patricia was talking to me before about deafness, that it's really helpful for people that are deaf, which it seems very, it helps them to listen more carefully and selectively.
It's more that they're able to compensate in other areas of the brain or using other areas of the brain. But this is, again, in mostly music performance, not so much in listening or different types of therapies.
Well, people that have had music training, though, that it doesn't help.
Oh, yes. So it does. So with so this isn't complete deafness, but if you are a musician and you're losing your hearing as an older adult, you still have better hearing than someone who's a non-musician. At least that's what studies have shown. And I don't know if there's anything really else that, Dr. S, you want to add to that. But
yep. And I would also say, like, in terms of music and deafness, there's cochlear implants that are often used for those that have gone, that are deaf, especially children. And they actually, there's a lot of literature on using music and, again, music therapy to help children with cochlear implants learn to talk and hear again. Again, I think that has to go back between that noisy signal of speech versus not as noisy with music, that it's a easier signal for the brain to process. So now you have this implant that actually only has a couple leads to it. It doesn't stimulate the entire frequency range. And so something like music can be very helpful.
I didn't think much about this, but people have to be sort of trained to listen. My brother-in-law, he's deceased now, but my husband's brother had meningitis. He had meningitis,
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he went deaf when he was a small child. He had learned to speak a bit before, but not much. So then he's completely deaf. Well, when he was well into his 50s, they said, you're an ideal candidate for the cochlear implant. So he had both of these, and it was all inflamed. They didn't turn it on. They were waiting to turn it on. Okay, well, his wife is all, you know, dying to, you know. What was the first thing you noticed when you're hearing? She was expecting, you know, your voice, sweetheart. And it was the sound of his own footsteps, which we don't even notice normally.
Right.
And then quite often he'd hear things, and he'd have to run to his wife and say, what's that noise? What's that noise? And it was like the highway was miles away, but it was the highway, the traffic on the highway. And another time it was birds singing in the morning and so on. And he had great trouble tuning this out. And the noises that most of us don't even notice, we tune them out, they were sort of annoying to him. And he wanted to turn his cochlear off and so on.
And that's that inhibition thing that Patricia was talking about, that we know that with music and musicians that they're better at tuning out those sorts of noises and things.
Yep. And you have to remember his so he went deaf. How old he was little?
He was preschool, but he had learned to speak a bit.
Kind of just going back to why he wasn't able to tune things out. Again, your brain generally is maturing. We find later and later and later. Right now, it's, I think, up to the 30s. Your frontal lobes aren't really fully mature. The auditory cortex, or the area of the brain responsible for processing and hearing speech, that, I think, matures at 7 years of age. So since he wasn't 7 years old, he might not have that experience of being able to inhibit those sounds as well.
Okay.
So maybe that's
that
why the first thing you turn it on, and he's overwhelmed by all of the stimuli. And
Which you'd never had a chance to cope with before.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because it was preschool, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were mentioning autism, people on the autism spectrum. This is very helpful to them also.
Yeah, music therapy is used a lot with children with autism. Mainly, well, there's the social aspect of it, obviously, but helping to with speech, movement. Actually, there's a lot of new research that's coming out that is looking at how autism may actually be somewhat of a movement disorder, and that you can obviously, in my view, you would use the music to help them move better. So there's a lot of stereotypical movements. There's also the lack of what they call mirror neurons in the brain. And those are neurons that if I were to do a movement, they will, and you see it, those neurons would be active. And those same neurons are active if you do the movement. So
right. There's a lot being written about
mirror neurons.
Really like, really interested in it, because it seems to show us a natural fellow feeling between people. So in other words, you're doing something, my mirror neurons will reflect that.
Right. And so
shows a sort of feeling between us or something.
Exactly. So like if I smile, you would like smile back. Mirror neurons are actually involved in that sort of emotional processing, but they're also going to be involved with music on a level. So if I'm playing a certain style of music, you're going to respond to it, and you're either going to want to respond in your own way or
get up and dance,
or communicate back. And so things like what we call and response are very useful for children with autism. And I've seen that children with autism also tend to respond better with music. And again, it may be the same thing. So another theory with autism is, we talked about how all those neurons are they have to be connected to learn something new. But around that age of 3, you actually start pruning away connections that you don't need. And there's always, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's for more aging. But we actually need to prune away connections that we don't need to use. Otherwise, we process too much information. And there's a theory with autism that happens around the age of 3, when the brain starts pruning itself, that the pruning doesn't happen in all areas of the brain in children with autism. And that's usually when we begin to see those symptoms come up in children with autism.
So people don't show autism till they're about 3.
Yes. And so they think that this trigger, this developmental trigger in the brain to start pruning itself, doesn't happen in all regions of the brain. So you can imagine, if you're overconnected, then you're processing all of this stimulation.
And then everything on your skin and everything, that you become too sensitive to
and
everything.
It can be overwhelming. So the same thing can happen in like a speech signal, which again has more noise, more information to process, versus a music signal that's a little bit less noisy, less information to convey. And things like that may actually be used to help improve social, cognitive, motor skills, speech skills in children with autism.
Now, the other two areas I thought of are dementia and general end-of-life issues and music therapy in those areas.
Do you want me to go with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I again, that's definitely, you have more experience in that than I do, for sure.
So dementia, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence here, and I think we see it's becoming more popular where you see folks that when they're just in their normal environment are demented, they're not engaged in their environment, they don't know where they're at, things like that. But as soon as you start playing music, they become orientated, they are engaged with their spouse, they're singing along, singing the music. And in all honesty, that was my first witness as a music therapy student, was that I had a lady that was severely demented, and I was playing music, and she sat up and she sang every single word to the song that I was doing.
Oh, it must be something she was already familiar with.
That was she is familiar with. And then she, as soon as the music was over, she went back into that state. And I was like, whoa. And that's what drove me into neuroscience, to understand what's happening. And the only explanation I can give, again, is that it's music. So when the dementia sets in, it sets in where you lose more of your more recent memories. And so music has this, especially music from, most of the music that we remember are from our teenage and early 20 years. And those are our preferred music styles that we tend to continue to listen to throughout life. And so those are really old memories that are still there. It's just, and music allows us a way to get at those memories and pull them out so that they become right. more engaged. The question is then, can we do something when we get them into the state where they are now engaged in their environment and aware of where they are? Can we do something in that state with them to help them delay the progression of the disease or become aware of where they are at that current moment in time? And those are some areas that are still
and
up
that's
for...
that's still a big question mark.
Question mark, yeah. Amazing.
Well, could say when they're singing songs from their 20s, they're not engaged in the present.
Exactly. So whether they're engaged in the present, they're still engaged with whoever it is that's providing that
right.
stimulus. So
yeah.
then how can you turn that into a being involved in the present?
And there's not the beginnings of an answer to that yet?
I think that goes back to the need for more neuroscience research in this area.
So it's still a huge question mark there. But it's obviously therapeutic, at
yes.
least in the short term anyway.
Most definitely.
Okay, how about end-of-life issues?
So what we know with end-of-life issues in music therapy is that you can use music, and particularly relaxing music, to relieve stress, which end-of-life is a stressful event. Not only for the person going through it, but also for the family. And so using calming music can help reduce stress. But I've also seen where they have used music, they match the patient's heart rate if they're in an anxious state, even if they're unconscious. But they're anxious, something has happened to their state
physiologically
where their heart rate has gone up. And I've witnessed it. I was amazed, but they go in and they match that heart rate, and then they slowly slow the tempo of the music down, mm-hmm. and they see that the heart rate also decreases and oxygenation goes up, and they bring that patient back into a relaxed state. So oftentimes in end-of-life care, especially at the moment when they're taking them off the ventilator and things of that sort, they will have a music therapist present because it brings down the heart rate, it brings the body into a relaxed state, and it's a much more peaceful transition for the person that's going through that transition, but also for the family at that time. So it's an amazing gift that these music therapists have. I personally don't have it. Like, just thinking about it and the experience that I had witnessed makes me want to cry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that strong of a person to be able to do that, but it's a phenomenal experience to be in, and I think there still needs to be a lot of research so that more and more people can have that experience for end of life.
You've mentioned that it's always a live music, someone playing an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know it's a heresy for me to say this, but wouldn't recorded music work just as well? And if not, why not?
So the live music, part of the reason is because you can adjust the tempo almost immediately and you meet the needs of the patient that's with you. So music therapists almost always use live music.
So if you have to adjust the tempo immediately, you must be able to see you're yes. reading from some
They're reading
monitor.
The machines on the monitor.
Okay. Yeah. So you're paying attention to that. I see. Mm-hmm. I'm playing a violin or whatever. I'm trying to get a picture of what's
usually,
going on here.
Usually the ones that I've seen have been with harp.
In heaven already with a harp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's amazing. But violin, guitar, I've seen it done with guitar as well. Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at the monitor and you're playing your harp. Or harps are big things to move
yeah,
around.
Yeah, it is. So. It is. They roll them through the hospital.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I think that just about covers anything, something, everything.
You've been listening to KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Today, my guests were graduate student Patricia Izbicki, who's got a music background and is getting a PhD in neurology, and also Patricia's professor, Dr. Elizabeth Stegmoller, who's in the Department of Kinesiology at ISU and is also a music therapist and neuroscientist. But before we go, Dr. Stegmoller, would you please remind us once more of your special singing and movement groups for people with Parkinson's disease?
We have weekly groups for people with Parkinson's disease. So we meet weekly to sing together. And again, it's therapy. So it's to actually improve, not necessarily to make you a great singer.
It probably doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. But I always get the comment, I can't sing. And I'm like, well, we don't care about that. Uh-huh. So we care about using it for therapy to protect against these swallow issues and whatnot. But there's also a huge social component that has developed with the group and camaraderie with the folks. Being able to sing with other people with Parkinson's disease is pretty phenomenal. So we meet on Wednesdays from 3 to 4 at the First Baptist Church for singing group. And then we also have an exercise and music and dance group, which is a lot of fun as well. And that is also at the First Baptist Church in Ames on Tuesdays at 4:00.
How should they get in touch with you if they want to participate?
So my number is 515-294-5966. 515-294-5966. Or email esteg@iastate.edu.
Okay. So it's the first part of your name and then the Iowa State. I'll just repeat that. esteg@iastate.edu.
Correct.
And the phone number again, 515-294-5966. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.